WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In every generation since the dawn of man, there have been those predicting the impending end of the world. We have had them, too, with a cluster of prognostications in just the last few years. But no prediction of the end time has captured so much attention as that surrounding the ancient Mayan calendar. It seems that that calendar ends on December 21st. Maybe. 2012, that's next week, NASA received so many inquiries about some heavenly body or piece of space junk that might be headed our way to end it all that they felt compelled to issue a statement last week assuring the world that there was nothing up there in the firmament that would do us in, at least not by next week. Even the people involved in the Mayan Cultural Festival are planning next year's event. But just in case they're wrong and the Mayans were right, we thought we'd take a closer look and let you decide whether to party like it's 1999 for the rest of the week. Dr. Dori Rentz-Budet Dr. Dori Rentz-Budet is curator of the Arts of the Americas at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, and is the consulting curator of Native Art of the Americas at the Mint Museum, and she joins us for the hour. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
Good to see you. NASA, last week, as I said, said that nothing was coming from outer space to do us in. Nothing was on a collision course. But did the Mayan calendar really predict that the world would end?
Absolutely not. There is nothing in the hieroglyphic inscriptions from the ancient Maya that say anything about the end of the world.
Then why do we think this is the end? Why do some people are they're so convinced that the calendar ends, that's it, curtains?
Well, it's based on a misinterpretation of a hieroglyphic text from the 7th century from the site of Tortuguero in Mexico, and also a total misunderstanding of the nature of the Maya calendar.
Wow. And we've let this go on and on. Why haven't people like you who know the real truth come forward earlier to say, just stop this nonsense?
Actually, we have, and there's, nobody listens to scholars and because we're dry and boring. But there's plenty of material on the web. Two sites in particular, FAMSI, FAMSI.org, mm-hmm. and MesoWeb.org, have wonderful expositions by noted scholars about the supposed end of the world and explanations of how the calendar works. In fact, if we look at the Maya calendar, it's composed of three different kinds of calendars. It's very precise, and it's a marvel of mathematical intellectualism. There's one calendar that's what we call the human calendar. It's based on a calendar or a cycle of 260 days. One should ask, what is 260 days? That calendar is actually based on the human gestation period, the period from conception to birth. And it is this calendar that the ancient peoples of Mesoamerica used to name their children. There are two other calendars associated with the Maya calendar. One is a solar calendar of 365 days. It's a way of keeping track of the sun. It's a way for any farmer to have a kind of solar almanac to know when to plant, when to be preparing the fields for planting, and when to start harvesting. And then there's a third calendar that's based on a 20-year or 20-day cycle. It's based on interdigitated cycles of 20. This is a sacred calendar, and it's connected to ancient Maya ideology and their model of the universe. It's their understanding of time as the landscape of history.
So the calendar that ends on December 21st or 24th, which we'll talk about, which calendar is that?
It's the sacred calendar. It's
sacred
the third
calendar.
One.
And it's been going all this time since the Mayans were walking the earth and ruling the civilization as we knew it back then in that part of the world.
Correct. And it even was going on way before the Mayas showed up, and it's going on way into the future.
So why does it end?
It doesn't. That's
the whole
point.
Why do we think it does?
Because Again, back in 2001, mm-hmm. when our country was going through some major upheavals and people were most upset about whether or not the world was going to continue for mm-hmm. obvious reasons, mm-hmm. there was a misreading of this hieroglyphic text from the 7th century at Tortuguero in Mexico. Subsequently, in 2003, the epigraphers, were people who decipher Maya hieroglyphic writing, realized their error in reading a verb, which they thought said to end. In fact, all it says is to be investitured, to be dressed. And I'm going to read that text for you in Chol Mayan and in English here
moment. Oh, wow, okay.
So what happened was the misidentification of the hieroglyph from 2001 continued, and nobody caught on to the fact that there were these scholarly papers circulated on the internet and at scholarly conferences giving the new reading of this verb. And so it was the error was perpetuated and is continuing today. The other thing that's happening here is that people who are followers of Nostradamus, of the savant Nostradamus, have noted that there are apparently some points in his writing saying that the world will end this year. It was supposed to end 14 years ago, and it didn't. But, you know, that's the way prognostications go.
That's the way it always is. Somebody will predict the end of the world with great surety. People will start stocking up for the doomsday. Mm-hmm. It will come and go. We're still here. And then they'll say, well, it's going to happen next year.
Yes.
And people will do it all over again.
Well, the ancient Aztecs did the same thing. There's part of this misunderstanding about the supposed end of the world is a bad reading of this very large stone in Mexico called the calendar stone, which actually is an altar. It's not a calendar stone at all. But it was made in 1502, not in 700 AD when the Maya supposedly predicted the end of the world. So it's 1,000 years later, and it's a completely different culture. And in and on this stone are bits of information that tell us about the previous creations of the world and the fact that this world, our current, our fifth age, will end. It just doesn't tell us when.
So now, this is not unlike what we went through at the change of the millennia, correct?
It's exactly the same.
And we argued about whether it was 1999 to 2000 or 2000 to 2001. I think everybody, not everybody, but experts will say it changed between 2000 and 2001, despite our protestations to the contrary. But 2000 ended the 20th century, but it didn't end time. It didn't end the world. It just ushered in the beginning of the 21st century. So that's the same thing that's happening here with the end of this calendar. It starts over again.
Exactly. The Maya calendars, including the sacred calendar, function exactly like our Gregorian, our European calendar. 2012 means 2 periods of 1,000 years, 0 periods of 100 years, 1 period of 10 years, and 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a count forward
right.
from a particular beginning date. The Mayan calendars work exactly the same. They're simply these bigger cycles of time.
So this has been going on for a very long time. Why would somebody make a mistake like that? Why would they think, as they read whatever they were reading, that this thing was going to end in 2012, since it's been repeating and repeating and renewing for years and years and years?
It seems to be inherent to the human psyche to want to live on the edge, to be thinking about our inevitable demise, and to be placing this in a larger social context. And I think a lot of what's been happening here with people latching on to the supposed Maya end of the world is that it's a reflection of the angst that permeates our contemporary world.
Now, I read over the weekend that there are still Mayans, descendants of the Mayans, out there, and some of them think that this whole end of the world thing was being promoted by the government down there in that part of the world and by tourist factions, because they knew they could drum up visitorship in advance of all of this if they said, no, don't you want to be here when the world ends? Is that part of what's going on?
Absolutely. And the folks who are predicting the end of the world, they're selling lots of books and they're giving lectures and getting very high fees for their lectures. They're sponsoring tours to the archaeological sites to be in the center of the Maya universe when the supposed end of the world takes place. It's also a marvelous opportunity for the governments in the countries where the Maya live today, in Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, to reinvigorate tourism in these marvelous corners of the world. Great places to visit, wonderful cultures, just some of the finest people you'll ever meet anywhere, to bring tourism back after the economic crash and, of course, all the problems that our drug trade is causing in these nations.
Now, we've said that the predicted end date was next week, December 21st, or it could be December 24th. Why? How could it be either or?
Because Pope Gregory, maybe I think he was the second, way back in the 16th century, got together a bunch of astronomers. They noticed that the sun wasn't where it was supposed to be according to the calendar. And so there was an adjustment in the calendar to deal with that fraction of a year that we accrue every year, because the solar cycle is not exactly 365 days. And so there is an adjustment of 4 days that was done in the 16th century. But the calendar that the Maya were using when the Spanish showed up in the 16th century, and all of the writings that we have from the Maya from the 16th century into present time, all of that is based on the Julian calendar, which is the calendar in use before the 4-day adjustment.
Hmm. It's remarkable to me that people back then, with the technology they had available to them, which is nothing, were able to realize that the year was 365 days, and it crosses cultures, it crosses oceans. They didn't talk to each other because they couldn't. How did they all arrive at this at the same time?
Well, again, mathematics are integral to our human brain. We count. Mm-hmm. And we also, everybody started out as agriculturalists, or once they discovered agriculture, and they needed to know when to plant. And so it was crucial to start observing nature. Mm-hmm. And even, of course, even going back to hunter-gatherer times, you had to know when the herds, when the migrations would be taking place. And so counting time, looking at the celestial bodies, is one of the first sciences ever developed by humanity.
How do we learn to read these hieroglyphs that they wrote in? I mean, how do we know that we've translated them accurately and that we've read them accurately? How do we know?
Well, it's an ongoing debate, and the first real breakthroughs were made by a Russian linguist, Yuri Konorossov, in 1952. And in the ensuing 60-plus years, we have been deciphering the texts. And there are probably about 100 people in the world who are the top epigraphers who are working diligently on the decipherment. And everybody is sharing information and testing each other's readings. So if you translate a hieroglyph in one context and you find it in another, if the context and the sense of the decipherment hold in the second context, you're very likely correct in your decipherment.
You used the word verb. You said that somebody had mistranslated a verb when they made this mistake in the calendar. These are all pictures. How can you tell a noun from a verb, from an adjective, from a picture? How can you tell?
Well, they're actually not pictures. It's a Maya hieroglyphic writing is what we call a logographic writing system. That is a system that uses a sign to stand for a phonetic sound. So, for example, we would have a circle with a dot in the center that would stand for the what we would have is a combination of a vowel and a consonant, A and H, ah. And so you put all of these together, all of these little signs together, these logographs, and you get a word.
We'll explore that more when we come back from the break, because I think that's fascinating, and we'll talk more about the Mayan calendar, too. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Dance Theater, presenting Nutcracker, a Charlotte holiday tradition with over 100 performers and live music by the Charlotte Symphony, now through the 23rd at Belk Theater. Tickets at ncdance.com. Christmas.org. That's not the only holiday entertainment on tap. Movies are just chock full of holiday surprises. It's that time of year when Hollywood rolls out its second big crop of movies. And this year, there appear to be a lot of blockbusters, from Lincoln to The Hobbit, from Zero Dark Thirty to Les Miserables, plus the latest James Bond flick and a new take on Anna Karenina, and a lot of romantic movies out there. There appears to be something for everybody, but are any of these films any good? We bring in our trio of movie critics tomorrow to give us the scoop. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the mortgage interest deduction is a key factor in many household budgets and the overall housing market. Who would be hurt and who'd be helped if Congress changes the rules?
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the end of the world, not, as not predicted by the Mayan calendar, with Dr. Dori Rentz-Boudet, Curator of Arts of the Ancient Americas at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, and the Consulting Curator of Native Art of the Americas at the Mint Museum. You just showed me a bit of this hieroglyphics that you're going to read from in a second. And where can people go on the internet to see what we're talking about?
I would, if they want to see the hieroglyphic text that I'm going to read for you, I would search on the name of the archaeological site, Tortuguero, T-O-R-T-U-G-U-E-R-O. And you'll get all sorts of links to photographs of the monument and drawings of the monuments, and in fact, you can even get the paper by Barbara McLeod called "The God's Grand Costume Ball," mm-hmm. where the translation has been most recently done, and I think is the most accurate we have.
I think we have stolen their format of writing here for our computer stuff and for our smartphones, because they look like a collection of what we, you know, 5,000 years from now, if somebody turns on a computer that we've left behind, all the desktop icons, they might go, is that writing? What is that? Because it looks like what those little icons look like the Internet Explorer icon would be one, and the, the Firefox icon might be another. They're just little pictures.
Those
all mean something different.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really good analogy. All of the little pictures that we use now on our smartphones and on our computers, those are logographs. Those are signs that refer to something else. Like the Windows, yes, it is a picture of a window, but really what it's referring to is an operating system.
Right.
So that's a logograph.
So the little F that we see on websites now, meaning Facebook.
Correct.
That's what we're talking about.
Exactly.
But those are, they chiseled these on stone. And they look incredibly complicated. I mean, they're little zeros, or not zeros, but little O's in a bunch of these. Does the position of those O's and the number of those O's in each of those little logotypes mean something different? Is that part of the thing, or is that a component of it? If you took one of those O's out with the other image in that logotype, would it mean something different?
It would depend if those little circles are numbers, mm-hmm. if they're being used as numbers, or if they're part of a sign.
And how do you know?
From the context. It's like if I said 8 fish. You don't know if I said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 fish, mm-hmm. or I ate fish. Mm-hmm. What you need to know is the context of the sentence. Eight fish. I ate fish. That context tells you that 8 is a verb. Mm-hmm. It's not the numerical coefficient.
Okay.
So the same thing happens in Maya hieroglyphic writing. So it's the context that tells you whether or not you're dealing with a circle as a number or as part of a sign.
Is the grammar that they used similar to the grammar that we would recognize as English grammar or contemporary, pick a language?
How about the 28 Mayan languages that are spoken today? Yes, absolutely. This is Maya hieroglyphic writing is a true writing system. It is a graphic representation of spoken language. So anything...
And the only one in North America.
And the only one
in the Americas.
In the Americas, exactly. So it is... Maya hieroglyphic writing follows very strict rules that are based on grammar and then also based on the internal rules of the writing system itself, just as our writing is left to right. That's an inviolate rule unless we want to start playing around with design. And the Maya did that as well. What also complicates Maya hieroglyphic writing for so many people is similar to our printed letters and cursive letters. The Maya had three different forms of a sign that they could use. They could use a geometric version. They could use a head variant, which is the head of a deity or a supernatural person that stands for that sign or logograph. Or they could use a full figure version. So
one more formal than the other? Was one for, you know, religious ceremonies, another for secular involvement, like the publishing the menu at the local whatever?
To a certain extent. If we look at the four surviving Maya books that are almanacs and mathematical tables for the Venus cycle, et cetera, astronomical texts in essence, those are very simple. They use the block form of the glyphs.
Okay.
But beyond that, for all of the texts that we find in stone or painted on walls, whether or not the scribe chooses one form or another is whether or not the scribe was going to show off or whether the patron was, you know, had fancy taste or not.
So you're going to read a piece of this in what, both language in English, but first you're going to read it in Mayan?
Chol.
In
yeah.
Chol.
Chol Mayan. Okay.
Well, this should be interesting. What are you reading?
This is the last phrase of a very large hieroglyphic panel carved in stone from the site of Tortuguero in Mexico.
Okay.
This is the text that caused all the brouhaha initially back in 2001 when we epigraphers made a suggestion for deciphering the verb, and it turns out we were wrong and corrected ourselves in 2003. So this is the section. Chak kin bolon winik ush hab, washak winik hab ush pik, zutzom ush lahun pik, chanahau ush uniu, utomil yen bolon yokte ta chak hoya. 2 days, 9 score days, 3 tunes, 8 cartoons, and 3 peak forward in time, it will be completed the 13th peak. It will be for a how, 3 kankin, that is December 21st, 2012. It will happen. The witnessing of the adornments of Bolon Yokte in the great investiture.
I don't even know where to begin. What's a tune?
All of those numbers are parts of the Maya calendar, the sacred calendar. A tune is a period of 20 days times 13.
So what they're saying is that on December 21st, 2012, the cycle will end and begin again? Is that what they're saying?
No, it says it will happen. The witnessing of the adornments of Bolon Yokte in the great investiture.
What does that mean?
What it says is that the deity Bolon Yokte will be manifest and he will be dressed in his proper regalia. That's where we made the mistake in the verb. Initially, we had thought that the yen was yin because of there was a break in the in the stone,
uh-huh.
And somebody had read the first sign as yi, not as ye, and that verb is made up of two parts, ye and ni. They read it yi ni, and that means end.
Ah.
In fact, we have people have gone and looked at the stone itself and realized that was a terrible mistake, that it's the phonetic sign yay.
So what does it mean that this deity will manifest itself and be dressed appropriately?
This is intimately and directly connected to the Maya philosophy of time and the role of rulers to maintain the cosmic order. At the end of particular time periods, such as we do on December 31st, at the end of our year, we get together and have parties. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, we are baptizing the new year.
Okay.
We're closing out the old year. We're doing these rituals to end the year and to kind of cleanse ourselves for a new year. We make all these resolutions. We say we're going to be better people, et cetera. In the Maya view of time, the same thing would happen when a particular time period ended, be it a 365-day solar year, be it a 20-year period, be it a 260-day period. There were proper rituals to be done to make sure that the cycle will renew itself, that in essence, as the gods did at the beginning of the world, when they infused the universe with life force and caused life to blossom everywhere in the universe, so too is it necessary for the Maya rulers to reenact this initial investiture of the world with life force that the gods did at the moment of creation. And so what is happening here in this text is actually the ruler of Tortuguero. The purpose of that monument is to tell us when he became king in 693, I think it was. But then he ties his accession to the 13000 date, which is happening next week. And what he says in the text earlier is that he is undertaking these rituals at that point in 693 to ensure then that on 13000, when all of the rituals are going to have to be taken place, that he's already done them to ensure that Belon Yokte, this deity, will be baptized, will be invested with all of his proper...
And why did he do it then? Because he was coming into power or because the calendar was beginning anew then? I mean, why did he do it then? Why did he do all those rituals at that time?
He was doing it because he was a very religious man.
Okay. Now, you read in Mayan. How do we know what it sounded like?
We know... There are two ways. Of course, there are 28 different Mayan languages spoken today, so we have native speakers of Chol today. There's also a part of anthropology called anthropological linguistics. And what these linguists do is they've worked out ways to reconstruct languages, how they sounded 1,000 years ago, based on different kinds of language change that have been tracked in known history through written texts over the past 500 years. It's called the Benjamin Whorf hypothesis, and it's about a 100-year time-honored way of reconstructing language. Of course, we will never really know what these languages sounded like. We can get an approximation of them. And again, with 28 different Mayan languages spoken today, we have a lot of material.
And the people today speaking Chol, is that the language?
Well, that's this one, yes.
Okay. Do they write it the same way today as they did thousands of years ago?
No. Maya hieroglyphic writing was forbidden to be used when the Spanish showed up in the 16th century. It was, remember, this was the time of the Inquisition, and anyone caught... writing in hieroglyphs was basically tortured, put to death. And in 1539, Bishop Diego de Landa, the first bishop of Yucatan, burned every single book he could get his hands on. And in his treatise, the Relaciones de las Cosas de Yucatan, he said, I found all these books, and I know in them are all of their affairs of state and other things, including lies of the devil that are enslaving these people to a life in hell because they're worshiping the devil. But to free their souls, I burned them all. And then he says, to which they regretted to a great degree.
Yeah. Aren't we special people? Place the Mayans in time and space. When did their civilization flourish? For how long? Where? How much do we know about their lives and their civilization?
There have been great advances made in the past 50 years in archaeology for understanding Maya history. We can identify human beings in the areas where the Maya live today back to 8,000 years ago.
Mm.
The the beginning of the major advancements in monumental architecture and hieroglyphic writing goes back to about 800 BC. What we call the classic period, when all the really big pyramids were made and all of these carved stone monuments, that's roughly the first millennium AD, when Europe was falling into the Dark Ages and was a total mud hole, and the average lifespan was something like 23 years. This was the heyday of Maya civilization.
And in their heyday, how large was the population? How complex was their society? What did one king rule over the entire shebang, or was it tribal in nature? Would you compare it to a European nation in the way it existed, or would you compare it to more like Native Americans in North America being the generic term? But then you have the Cherokees, and you have the Apaches, and you have all these different languages and customs, etc.
Maya civilization during the classic period was an extremely complicated social and political affair. I think the best analogy I can make is Renaissance Europe, with these myriad city-states all vying against each other and intermarrying with each other for power, for control over human resources, control over trade, economics, and control over the political landscape. I think you can get a really good sense of the complexity of Maya civilization if you go to the Mint Museum and just walk through the gallery dedicated to Maya art. You'll see a vast array of different painting styles of beautifully painted ceramics that are, in essence, paintings on curved surfaces, equal in visual and intellectual aesthetic complexity to anything that you'd see from European art.
I want to spend some time in the next segment talking about that, because I don't think many people know of the extensive nature of the collection of this kind of art at the Mint Museum. We will talk about that in the next segment. But these people, these Mayan people, some of the rituals that they engaged in, for whatever reason, to placate the gods for a good agricultural season, for bringing a new king into fruition, whatever, seem barbaric to us, and probably seemed barbaric to the Spanish when they came there in the 1600s, because there was a lot of human sacrifice. But aside from what we see as barbaric, were they barbaric, or were they highly intelligent and civilized for their time?
Well, Maya definitely is one of the great civilizations of the world. And actually, the issue of human sacrifice has been, I think, misunderstood and in many ways greatly expanded in the numbers that actually took place. Yes, it did happen. So did human sacrifice happen in the Judeo-Christian religion. We just don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Maya, for example, you will read that at the end of the ball game, the losers got sacrificed. Well, think about it. The ball game was, on the one hand, yes, a very sacred ritual, but it also was a sport. If you go around killing your teams, the losing team, you're going to end up with, first of all, nobody to play against, and second of all, nobody's going to become a ball player.
Right.
So just thinking of it prosaically, there's got to be something wrong with the picture, and right. There is. And also, the concept that we have of massive amounts of human sacrifice comes to us from the Spanish writings in the 16th century of the Aztecs in Highland Mexico. So it comes to us from 1,000 years later, totally different culture. It's as if you were trying to explain what the Swedes were doing from what the Palestinians are doing.
I see.
You know, they share some things in their backgrounds, but they're really very, very different peoples and different points in time.
And in terms of importance, influence, largeness, et cetera, what are the Aztecs? How do the Aztecs compare to the Mayans? And I have 20 seconds.
They inherited 3,000 years of human history, and in less than 100 years ended up ruling all of Mesoamerica.
They being?
The Aztecs.
The Aztecs. We have to take a break. We're going to come back more and talk about the Mayans and the end of the world and the extensive collection of art at the Mint Museum that relates to this. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for more than 30 years. Donald Hack Diamonds buys and sells estate jewelry across from South Park Mall, 704-365-4400 or online at donaldhack.com. And Leap Design, a full-service graphic design studio providing brand identity and design services for businesses and organizations. Details at leapdesign.com. The mortgage interest deduction is a key factor in a lot of household budgets and the overall housing market. Who would be hurt and who would be helped if Congress changes the rules as we approach the fiscal cliff? Find out more about that at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
I knew that when I finally had to say goodbye to Killian, it would be tough because he was such a huge part of my life. I had to schedule the time for him to be picked up as a time that I wasn't there because I would just lose it. It was just great to know that he was making radio now. He wasn't just sitting in my driveway. My name is Jessica Frazier. I donated my 1994 Chevy Lumina to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Dori Rentz-Bedett is with us, Curator of Arts of the Ancient Americas at Museum of Fine Arts Boston, and also the Consulting Curator of Native Art of the Americas at the Mint Museum. And this conversation is being precipitated by the impending end of the world, as predicted, not by the Mayan calendar, on December 21st or 24th, 2012. We've already talked about how this is not going to happen and how NASA is right, that there's nothing coming from outer space, but more importantly, that the calendar does not predict the end of the world. And you read first what it told it does mean in both Mayan or Chol and in English. What happened to the Mayans? Did the Spanish stamp them out? Is that what happened to them and their civilization, essentially?
The Maya didn't go anywhere. We still have about 6 million Maya living in Central America and Mexico and right here in Charlotte.
Do they identify as Maya?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And, in fact, they won't even say Maya. They'll identify themselves by their specific group.
Okay.
And based on their language. It's like if you went to Europe, yes, somebody might say, I'm European. But if you're in Europe, they're going to say, no, I'm French. Maya will say, I'm Yucatec, or I'm Chol, or I'm Kakchikel. Depending on which of the 28 languages they speak and what group they're connected to.
So the piece that you read in Chol, that would be associated with what group?
The Chol Maya live today in Chiapas in southern Mexico. And we were pretty sure in the classic period that the primary language used for the hieroglyphic inscriptions was one of the Chol family languages. There's still debate going on by the anthropological linguists and the epigraphers whether or not it's Chorti or Cholti, but they're all part of the Chol language family.
And just as would be the case, at least in centuries before, in places like Germany or Italy, you may not be able to understand each other if you were from the southern tip of the boot versus near the Alps in Italy. You might not be able to understand each other. Would that same be true of the Mayans? And would they be able to at least be able to read these things?
Yes, but the being able to read these texts, to be honest with you, a basic ability to read a hieroglyphic text can be learned in 2 days.
Really?
Uh-huh. And learning how the calendar works, learning to read the calendar glyphs, that's really very simple. And understanding the basic structure of the language, well, if you're already a native speaker, it's not a problem. So on the one hand, the reading part of it is not that difficult. What's difficult is the decipherment when you don't know what the signs mean or anything about the language.
But somebody from another part of the Mayan Empire, would they be able to look at that hieroglyph and read it, even if they didn't speak Chol?
Yes, absolutely, because all of the different speakers were using the same writing system.
How do you explain that? Because people can look at a book that's written in French and see that there are words on the page, but they don't know what those words mean if they speak only English.
Right. In first of all, the calendar system, people will understand a date whether they're looking at a date written in French or in Italian.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be able to at least understand, okay, that's a date. And because December and DCM are very similar, I would be able to read the French and understand, oh, yeah, that's the 21st of December. The same thing would be true for the Maya hieroglyphic writing. And also, Maya languages are divided into two large families. It's like we've got in Europe, we have the Germanic languages and we have the Romance languages. And English is a conglomeration of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So for Maya, we have the lowland languages and we have the highland languages. So for me, I speak Yucatec Mayan. And I can, when I'm in southern Guatemala where they speak highland languages, the other language family, I can listen to what they're saying and I can catch words and like counting and trying to buy something, I can use my lowland Mayan, Yucatec Mayan. And the people all laugh and think I'm really cute, but they understand more or less what I'm trying to get at.
How do these pictographs compare to the characters that you might see in native Japanese or Chinese? Are the principles the same?
The principles are very similar, absolutely. The Japanese characters are composed of smaller units, and you can put all of these units together to make words and sentences. Maya hieroglyphic writing works in a very similar manner.
Now, they kept a calendar. They kept various calendars. You mentioned at the very beginning of the program, they kept three kinds of calendars. They kept the human calendar, which was 260 days, which is the gestation period of a human being. They kept the solar calendar, which is 365 days. And they kept the sacred calendar, which was 20 days or 20 years in cycle. Why did they keep so many calendars? Was it because was it a religious preoccupation? Was it because they had a specific viewpoint of their own significance in place and time?
Yes, it's really having to do with the Maya's particular viewpoint of the universe. That on the one hand, the universe is unknowable. It is always expanding. It is always there. And it's composed of these, or the Maya try to express infinity, not through a never-ending line that goes on to the horizon and beyond, but instead by ever larger, larger, larger cycles. For example, there is one text from the site of Coba in Mexico that lists a date that is 20 or 13 periods of 20 to the 21st power. That number is so big, I don't even know what, I couldn't even say it in English. And in their texts, they're counting back millions of years in the past and million years into the future. What they're doing is they're placing themselves within this broader sacred nature of the ever-expanding and unknowable universe. So these calendars are ways of expressing the ideology, the religious and the intellectual ideology of their peoples.
Are there other people around the world who did things similar to the Mayans, who had similar points of view on their place in the universe and the universe's existence overall, or were they just trying to keep the seasonal calendar for agricultural purposes elsewhere?
No, elsewhere in the world, there all of the world's great religions are focused on trying to understand divinity, trying to understand the place of humanity in this larger pageant of time. The footprints of human history through time and how we fit when we have a finite existence, but yet the cosmos, divinity, the spirit world, whatever, does not. And in many ways, the Maya calendar is a way of interdigitating the finite linear nature of time as we humans experience it with the cyclical nature of universal time.
Now, it came as a great surprise to me, and I think it will come as a great surprise to many, that the Mint Museum on Randolph Road, the original Mint, has one of the largest collections of ancient American art in the country. How did we come to be the repository of that?
This is one of the great treasures of Charlotte, in my humble opinion, as a pre-Columbian scholar.
It's what brought you here, I would imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. The collection started back in 1956 with a very modest purchase, and then from that point on, especially in the 1960s and into the 1970s, a number of quite generous donors, foremost among them Dr. Francis Robicek, amassed this spectacular collection. What is so unusual about it in terms of comparison to other museums is that it just doesn't give us only Maya, ancient Maya art, or only ancient Peruvian art. It represents more than 38 cultures from northern Mexico to Chile and more than 3,600 years of human creativity.
Wow. Now, Dr. Robicek has been a guest on this program. He's a heart surgeon and researcher, and he and his wife, spent 40 years collecting this for themselves and made a great contribution to the Mint by allowing them to display it. And I guess maybe, I don't know whether he gave it to the Mint or whether it's just on display there, thanks to him. But it is, in fact, one of the most culturally comprehensive museum holdings in the world. Who knew?
Absolutely, right here in Charlotte.
Why is this such a secret? I mean, this is something you tout, it seems to me, since Charlotte so wants to be on the world stage. This makes us a world player, at least in this segment of art and culture.
We definitely are doing so. And many years ago, the education department at the museum worked together with the Mecklenburg County School System to develop a social studies program. And every year, 10,000 school children from the region came to the Mint Museum to learn about the cultures of the ancient Americas. So by bringing in all of these children, our expectation was that we would have a much broader understanding, and they'd go home and tell their parents how wonderful this was. And in fact, the Mint Museum is famous on the international stage for its collection. It's very well known whenever I'm giving public talks in Latin America or here in the United States or in Canada, and they see that I'm from the Mint Museum. They go, oh, we've heard about that fabulous collection. We have to get to Charlotte to see it.
How do they feel about that? I mean, how do the people in South America and Central America feel about this enormous collection of their cultural history being located in North America, first of all, and then in Charlotte? Why do they want it back?
Most people who I work with and have talked to and have known over the years are very, very happy to have these artworks here in Charlotte acting as ambassadors for their countries. They have marvelous treasures in their home countries. They have many pieces on display. Many of these countries also have very small museums with minuscule budgets at best, and they know that they can't possibly take care of all of these artworks. And so if an artwork is outside the country, is well cared for, is on display, is acting as an ambassador, is educating people here in the United States about the ancient cultures and the contemporary cultures of the countries of Latin America, they're very happy.
What does the presence of this collection at the Mint mean to you as an expert and as a scholar in this field? What does it allow you to do or learn that you perhaps could not do or learn in the absence of that collection?
For the general public, what it does is opens up the ancient Americas to join as equal partners to any of the great cultures of the world. We have had a tendency to consider the ancient Americas as, oh, well, just sort of, you know, Indians and just not really a sophisticated cultural milieu, when in fact having these collections here and being able to display the objects and talk about what the images on them mean and how they fit into a broader understanding from scholarship, this is just a marvelous way to increase our understanding of history.
Compare the Mayan culture and what it left behind, the art and its customs and things like that, to what indigenous people in North America left behind. Is there a similar collection of North American art? Did they create art like what we're talking about in North America, the indigenous people, similar to what the Mayans created? Do they have a calendar system that we know about?
There are certainly calendar systems. There are no other other writing systems in Northern America, in the northern parts of the New World. There are recording systems, ways of keeping track of, again, numbers and astronomical observations. The cultures of North America were absolutely as sophisticated as the Maya. The Mint is also unusual for having a wonderful collection of arts of contemporary Native peoples of the Americas. And so somebody can come to the Mint and see the ancient art from south of the border, but also see the contemporary art that their cousins here are making today.
Of the pieces in the Mayan collection at the Mint, what do you think is the most significant or several of the most significant works, and why?
There's one vessel, one of the few that Francis has not given to the Mint yet, though we're working on it, of a very large cylinder vase painted with a scene of a war victory celebration. And it is one of the most complicated pottery vessels scenes that I have ever encountered in 28 years of working on Maya art. And the hieroglyphic text, the painting style, the imagery itself gives us absolute details about what people wore, the kinds of rituals that happened when they celebrated war events. It even tells us about the feast that was going to take place afterwards.
Really?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And you get all of that from art?
All of that from art.
How do you know you're right?
Oh, because I'm a professional.
Apparently, the Sumerians first predicted that the world would end in 2003, but that didn't happen. And then the end was linked to the end of the current Mayan long count, which would be the 20-year cycle count, correct?
Yes.
Repeating over and over. Who made that link? Was it an expert who made that? The Sumerian thing didn't work out, so an expert said this is going to work out better. How did that happen?
There are people, spiritual people, who spend their lives looking for signs. And it's one of these people who started connecting the dots between the Maya calendar, Sumerians, Nostradamus, and astronomical events that are happening in the sky right now.
So when we all wake up on December 23rd and the world is still around us, or December 25th, given the fact that it may be the 24th that the world is supposed to end, and we all find out that we're certainly glad we did our Christmas shopping because it came. We're still here. Will there be something else to take its place in 5 years or 10 years? Another dire prediction of the end as foretold by some ancient culture.
Well, the 21st or the 24th is going to be 13000. There's always 13100000.
Which would be next year?
20 years.
20 years. Well, we'll look forward to that. Dr. Dori Rentz-Budette, Curator of Arts of the Ancient Americas at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, and the Consulting Curator of Native Art of the Americas at the Mint Museum, which has one of the most significant collections of this art in the world. And you can see it at the Mint on Randolph Road. Thank you for the hour.
My pleasure.